There'll be parties for hosting, marshmallows for toasting, and caroling out in the snow. There'll be scary ghost stories and ring the bell sucker of Christmases long, long ago. This is Movie Fighters, the show where...
That was Christmas. Very aggressive. That was an aggressive tone shift that you just dropped on everybody.
Well, we're going to ring the bell sucker. Chris Ems and I, Matt Wilson, we watch movies and beat them up. And it's December, which means it's time for us to watch a holiday film. This year, we're in a corner. We're in a little bit of a corner because there's no new holiday movie starring Mike the Miz Mizanin.
Very upsetting. Ruined the tradition.
There are no holiday movies starring Bill Goldberg.
Less upsetting, but yes.
And there's no new Kirk Cameron Christmas movie. Saving Christmas 2.
Quite a relief, I would say, on that one.
We had to dig into the bag. Dig into the bag of tricks. See what else is out there. See what's available. And what we found was one of two things on Netflix. One is was Beethoven's Christmas Adventure, which we thought would be appropriately terrible. But then we stumbled upon this other movie called The Spirit of Christmas. And I will read the Netflix description of The Spirit of Christmas to you now. As Christmas approaches, attorney Kate Jordan travels to Vermont to oversee the sale of an inn, where she falls for a handsome but cursed ghost. We thought that one sounded really interesting. It is apparently a TV movie from Lifetime. I ended up doing a poll on Twitter where I asked if people would rather us watch the Beethoven movie or this movie about a lady falling in love with a Christmas ghost. And Christmas Ghost won by a mile.
I was really surprised at that result. I was shocked.
I think it had like almost 70% of the vote.
Yeah, it was a landslide. It wasn't even like it wasn't even close.
I'm actually of the mindset that we shouldn't really learn much of anything about this movie.
I think anything we could learn about this movie would only take away from the movie itself. I will say, though, this year, have watched a lot of, like, ABC Family and Lifetime original Christmas movies, because they're on Netflix, and you can only watch White Christmas so many times, you know?
Sure.
Like, you can only watch the good stuff so many times. One of the movies that was suggested, but that we didn't do for Movie Fighters, because I had actually just watched it, like, last week, was The 12 Dates of Christmas, which is Groundhog Day on Christmas Eve, except the crux of the plot is that it's a lady who's going on a date with Mark Paul Gosselaar. Sidebar to the sidebar, have you seen Pitch? That dude's looking fucking good.
I have not seen him lately, but I feel like Mark Paul Gosselaar has been really bouncing back career-wise lately.
Matt, I didn't recognize him in Pitch, because he grew, like, a full beard, and he's like, it's like, it will give you pause when you see this man.
Zach Morris of today.
Anyway, that movie, highly recommended. 12 Dates of Christmas, load that shit up, watch it with someone you love. It's fantastic. You should, like, go for it. It's a fantastic Groundhog Day ripoff set at Christmas. Spirit of Christmas, like, it's got a hunky ghost in it. That's as far as I got.
I don't know if you said hunky or honky. Both are accurate.
I said hunky. Both are accurate.
No recognizable actors in this that I'm aware of. I will go down the IMDb page and point out a couple interesting things. One, the official website given on IMDb for The Spirit of Christmas is called Finance Company Website.
Is that like financecompanywebsite.com?
It's Marvista Entertainment. It's like it's the company that I believe produces all of these like made for TV movies.
Okay.
Like your Lifetime movies, your Sci-Fi Channel originals, and so forth. Then, scroll down a little more. It's got, like, select topics from the message board about this movie.
Okay.
And one of the subject lines is, his hair is correct for the period.
The period of, like, 2015? Like, whenever this movie came out?
I think the period that he was supposed to have lived in.
Okay.
Being a ghost. Although,
this was going to be my question for you, Matt. Like, I thought maybe since we're not going to, like, we're trying not to learn anything about this going in, I thought maybe we could make some predictions.
Sure.
And I was wondering, like, what you thought the odds were that he was not actually going to be a ghost.
I mean,
like, it's just, like, going to be, like, a weird, like, everybody thinks he's a, like, she thinks he's a ghost situation, but he's really just, like, a town weirdo.
That's entirely possible. I still don't think that's outside the realm of possibility.
Okay.
The tagline on IMDb is much more coy than the tagline on Netflix. The tagline on IMDb is just, a woman falls in love with a man who is somewhat unavailable.
This movie's already delightful. Like, we don't have to watch it, right? Like, we can just roll on into snack situation right now.
One more thing, apparently, from the message board, is that this movie was only shown once. Never re-aired.
Oh, right, because it was a live performance and all those people died.
I mean, maybe it's been re-aired this year. Because, I mean, it did only premiere in 2015, so who knows. But it was not shown multiple times last year. It was just shown one time. One more thing. Okay, if we're doing predictions.
Okay. I think we need to make some predicts.
Here's my hope. This isn't so much a prediction as a hope. How much does this sound like a scenario in the board game Betrayal at the House on the Hill?
So much. So much.
If you're unfamiliar with the board game Betrayal at the House on the Hill, it is a game where you as the players build a mansion, and then at some point in the process of, well, I guess you're exploring it, but the mansion is different.
You're horror movie characters, but you don't know what horror movie you're in yet. So you're just exploring a creepy mansion, and the way you explore it is as players. When you enter a new room, you draw a tile, and so you're building the mansion out as you go.
Yeah. So functionally, right, you're the actually doing the building because you're randomly drawing the rooms that you're exploring. As you explore, you eventually reach a point on a dice roll where the quote-unquote haunt occurs. And when the haunt occurs, that's when you find out what horror movie you're in. And it can be anything from a Cthulhu-like creature to a mummy, to vampires, to...
You can be shrunk down to tiny size, the house can be collapsing.
Everybody can have traps attached to them. I played one where you ended up being on the back of a giant bird. So there are lots of possibilities. Many of these scenarios, and in fact, the last time I played it, both scenarios involved someone in the group inexplicably falling in love with a ghost or monster. And trying to a marriage occurring, a wedding occurring.
Well, that's sweet, married.
This is absolutely one of those Betrayal at the House on the Hill scenarios. So anything that doesn't feel Betrayal at the House on the Hilly, I will be disappointed in.
I honestly hope part of this, I hope the inn in this movie is a random-ish and not quite sensical arrangement of rooms that are revealed one by one. That would be my hope.
The way that Netflix described the genres of this movie, the three genres given are holiday favorites, dramas, and romantic dramas. So nothing horror or spooky related in the genres, which make me a little concerned. It does go into the category of holiday favorites, though. So we've made a predic or two, and we've put our hopes on the table.
And since this is our holiday episode, this is our Christmas winter holiday episode, I think it's safe to say that Betrayal at the House on the Hill is collectively our favorite board game.
I would agree with that, yes.
So I would say, like, if you're listening to this, if you've got the headphones in as you're heading to the mall for a last-minute Christmas present, perfect gift for board game fans, for horror movie fans who have some friends. Great game to play with, you know, four or five of your closest pals. And if they've already got it, there's a new expansion out that looks rad as hell that I have, but I haven't actually played it yet.
I have played it with the expansion, and the expansion is great. The expansion does require some prior knowledge of the game, because there's sort of an assumption that you know how the game works. And so those scenarios are a little more involved. But it is really good. And it adds a roof. It adds a new level to the mansion. It's really good. All right. In just a minute, we're going to watch The Spirit of Christmas. But first, Chris, we've got to do the hottest segment in all of podcasting. Snack situation. You love to fight with something to eat. Sometimes it's savory, sometimes it's sweet. Snack situation. What's your snacking on? Chris, what are you snacking on over there?
It's the Christmas season. It's Christmas time. And what is Christmas, I ask you, without cookies?
Cookies are the ultimate Christmas snack, the Christmas treat, after maybe like candy canes.
Yeah, like, you don't leave candy canes out for Santa. I mean, you can, but that's not what he wants. That's not what he's after. Cookies are the best, and so I have some very, very special holiday cookies that were gifted to me by my one and only, my true love, my partridge in the pear tree, Aiden. At my request, I was like, you know, we got movie fighters coming up. We're going to have a snack situation. And she was like, okay, what do you want me to make? And I requested her famous brown butter chocolate chip cookies, which are delicious. They are fantastic. So I've got a plate of those right next to me. But as a backup, in case I need more cookies, I want you to see if you can hear this, Matt, because this is an audio medium. You hear that?
I hear a tin.
That is the holiday 2016 tin of white fudge covered Oreos.
Oh, very nice. I thought you might be going for the Danish sugar cookies, which I've done in the past. But the holiday Oreos, another good choice.
Here's the thing, though. We went out to buy holiday Oreos, and we got some like around Thanksgiving, because I think I talked about them on our Equestria Girls episode. But when we went back, they're gone, dude. I don't know if they've restocked, but there was a while where there was a shortage. You could not get these dudes in stores. So we had to order a 2-pack online, and it was like sent to us in these festive holiday tins. So it was involved.
Well, I'm glad that you were able to save the day and get those tins.
Matt, what are you snacking on today?
Much like you, I am snacking on something that's already been given to me as a gift. I visited my mom and my brother and sister-in-law and my niece and nephew in Shelby, North Carolina over the weekend, yesterday as of this recording. While I was there, my brother, Brian, handed me a jar. He was like, here's an early Christmas present. He handed me a jar of some Birdie County chocolate-covered peanuts.
Ooh.
They are fantastic. It is a wonder that I haven't eaten them all since yesterday. But I knew I wanted to save some for movie fighters. To be actually eating a Christmas gift while we're watching a Christmas movie. I'm snacking on some delicious chocolate-covered peanuts from Birdie County, North Carolina, a famous peanut spot, and they are very good. Some of the best chocolate-covered peanuts I've ever had. So, Chris, now that we have laid out everything that's going on with us snack-wise, there's no more waiting around.
Well, should we talk about how close we are to the Snack Situation solo podcast?
It's coming soon. We're about $85 away on the Patreon from being able to do monthly Snack Situation specials. And we are loaded for bear to do a monthly Snack Situation special. As we've mentioned before, we have big bags full of snacks from Beijing that we can't even identify because everything on the snacks is in Chinese.
Yeah, it's not the kind of adventure where you want us to have that while we're off mic watching a movie. Like, you want us to be live for that.
Yes. So, with just $85 more on the Patreon, in that ballpark, we will be able to do those snack situation specials and eat those Chinese snacks, which I think you want to hear. All right. No more beating around the bush. The Christmas tree? It's time to pause this. You're going to hear a musical interlude and an ad. We're going to watch a movie, and then we're going to come back and talk about The Spirit of Christmas. It is on Netflix if you would like to watch along with us. Be right back to talk about it. And we are back from watching The Spirit of Christmas, formerly known as Holly Grove.
You mean there was a time when this movie didn't have the word Christmas in the title?
There was at one time that potentiality.
So weird that they changed it, because it's got so much fucking Christmas in it, Matt. It's so festive and tied to the season.
There are so many different genres inside this movie. I read off the genres on Netflix, and they don't even begin to dig into what the genres of this movie are. Because it's like a legal drama slash murder mystery.
It's a full-on fucking horror movie for about the first 20 minutes.
The like least scary horror movie you've ever seen, but sure.
Look, we went into this movie knowing that it was about a woman who falls in love with a ghost, but if you didn't know that going in, and the movie was not called The Spirit of, if the movie was just called Holly Grove, right? And you got to that point in the movie where, like, there's a woman in a house, and she keeps calling the police because this guy keeps being in the house, and he's, like, fucking hiding in the floorboards, and, yeah. Like, when the cop leaves, he comes out, and he's like, I have all the keys. I know the codes to the alarms. You can't keep me out. Like, that's fucking scary! Like, I thought this movie was going to be too scary for me at a point.
That's fair. There is some horror movie baked in the first act. It's also, like, a workplace movie for a little while. It's not really a romance per se for big chunks of it. There's and the romance that there is sort
of out of fucking nowhere,
sort of nominal. It's so weird. It's so all over the place. And the resolution, like all the issues that the second act sets up, all the mystery that the second act sets up, are not paid off in any way.
No. Like it's a mystery that is literally solved by magical time travel memories. Right?
Well, that's maybe overstating it. It's really a mystery is solved because a ghost remembers something.
Yeah, but it's also, I mean, look, we'll get to it. Here's the only thing you know about The Spirit of Christmas. At one point, Kate, who is our main character, says to someone else, I'm just having a real hard time wrapping my head around all this, about the plot of this fucking movie.
Yep.
Like, yep. One of the characters literally goes, yeah, why isn't he, like, a ghost? Like, why isn't he? Because a guy says, like, yeah, it's really hard to believe. The thing I said was, like, yeah, like, if you were writing this, like, if it was a story, like, if you were making it up, it would not be this. Like, you would write a completely different set of attributes for this ghost, other than the ones we have.
It was one step away from the lead character, Kate, looking into the camera and saying, you can't make this shit up.
Which, I mean, well, like, do you want to talk about him being a ghost now, or do we have to, like, get into the plot? Because I'm ready to talk about, I have a theory as to why the fucking ghost shit in this movie works the way it does.
Let's nominally talk about the plot very quickly, and then we can get into the ghost stuff, because he shows up pretty quickly.
Yeah.
The movie starts with a flashback to the 1920s, even though this guy looks and acts like he has to be from the 19th century. But as we find out, he was a bootlegger slash rum runner in Vermont in the 1920s.
And he's from Vermont. He talks like Kevin Owens.
Yeah, well, he would make his rum runs up to Montreal.
Really picked up the accent.
He must have. The way this guy talks is so weird. But I want to talk about that. I want to totally set aside a part of this to talk about the actors, either in low points or in this part of the movie. So in the flashback, we see the lead actor, the lead male, who is Daniel, is his character's name. He's
literally forgot his name. We just stopped watching this movie 5 minutes and 30 seconds ago.
The actor who plays him is a Quebecer.
Quebecois, I believe is the...
He is Quebecois, yes. I think Quebecer is a person from
Quebec. Oh, he's an amazing French-Canadian, also known as the Quebecers.
Yeah. Thomas Boudouin, who I described as if you sent Josh Duhamel through a car wash. He approaches the inn in the 1920s. He sees his brother talking to his fiance, and while he's watching them hug in a very human, believable way, which we'll talk about that hug soon, too.
Oh, God. I want to talk about this hug. It's amazing.
While he's watching that, someone smacks him in the back of the head, and he falls down into the snow. We only find out much later that he got hit with a rock. Because every time his actual murder is shown on screen, it just looks like someone is popping him on the back of the head with their palm.
Yeah.
It does not look like a death blow at all.
This murder, by the way, is later going to be described by one of the characters in the present as, yeah, you know, they suspected foul play, but nothing was ever proven. Then we actually, even later on in the movie, we see him laying in the snow, bleeding out from the back of his head where he's had his skull caved in with a rock. And I was like, yeah, they could probably suspect foul play off that one.
So that's the flashback at the beginning. Cut to the present day, where we see our lead actress, lead character, Kate.
We see her on a date. We see her at dinner. Because Matt, look, she's a woman, but she's a very incomplete woman, if you know what I'm saying.
She's a woman from the go-go 90s. She's a woman who, she's got a career to worry about. So she's at this date with this guy who is basically about to break up with her. And
he looks like somebody left Will Wheaton in the dryer too long.
Her reaction to being broken up with, instead of being upset, is to be like, oh, thank goodness. I don't even really like you, and I don't want to be with you. Because, you know, she's so straightforward, because she's an attorney.
Well, she's been, instead of doing what I think we all know women should do, which is prioritizing their love life, she's been prioritizing her career, and she's not bothered at all that this guy who she says she's not actually that into is breaking up with her. Can you believe it? And at this point, I was watching this movie, and I was like, Matt, are we supposed to think that, like, Kate's bad? Because she literally says to the guy, she's like, yeah, look, I probably would prioritize our relationship above my career, but, like, I'm not really that into you. Like, I'm not gonna sacrifice a thing I want for something that I'm not actually that interested in pursuing just because you think I should. Which is, like, that's what a reasonable person says.
If it's at all unclear that she's gonna learn a lesson about prioritizing her love life over her career. There's literally a part later in the movie where her boss says to her, oh, you got to be here at our law firm for the Christmas party because that's where I'm going to announce your promotion. Priorities. And then she runs off to the inn to be with her new ghost boyfriend and says to him, priorities. Because you have to give up your job for a man.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're not having babies, what are you doing? What are you doing?
So
this movie's got a lot of weird messages.
The actress who plays Kate, her name is Jen Lilly. I kept making comparisons between her and Isla Fisher because in this movie she has red hair. Apparently she is normally a blonde. She also was on both General Hospital and The Days of Our Lives. And I was trying to figure out a way to describe her as being Isla Fisher if she blank. And it's Isla Fisher if she was on General Hospital in The Days of Our Lives. Also, on Jen Lilly's IMDb page, there are 8 personal quotes. Can I read some of these to you, Chris?
Oh, I wish you would, Matt. I wish you would.
All right, here's a good one. I think kindness is the secret to being beautiful.
Okay, fair. I would tend to agree.
I think rude people need a hug, a snack, and a nap.
I also think that.
The glass is completely full.
Okay.
That's 3 of the 8. You can go read the rest. Anyway.
Matt, can I tell you something? I wanted to see what she looked like blonde, because she does have kind of reddish, brownish hair in this movie. So I went and looked up Jen Lilly on a quick Google image search. Number 3 result, third, middle of the top tier here, is from WikiFeet. Because she is a celebrity.
Oh, good.
But that's not, I'm not here to talk about Jen Lilly's feet. I'm here to talk about how the backdrop she's standing in front of in this picture is a WWE backdrop. Did we do it? Did we accidentally find a connection to our Christmas hero, Mike the Miz Mizanin, with Jen Lilly?
Man, why would she be standing in front of a WWE backdrop? Unless, maybe she was in a WWE film?
That's what I'm trying to find out right now.
All right, while you're figuring that out, we'll continue talking about the movie. We see her at the law firm, and her boss tells her, this is his actual line, "You work harder than anybody here," which is something you never hear in an office setting, because they never want to tell you that. They want to make you work harder. So, but he tells her that. And then he says, there's this inn in Vermont. The owner has just died. There is no heir, which means that it goes to the trust, and the trust wants to sell it immediately. So what you got to do is you got to go to Vermont, get the inn appraised so we can know how much it's worth, and then sell it as quick as we can to satisfy the trust, because we're the executors of the will. The executors of the estate. So you go up there, you do this as quickly as you can. There is this weird little thing about a ghost story about this place.
It's haunted, by the way, this place is haunted.
He shows her a newspaper article about how the hotel is haunted.
He shows her a newspaper article and then goes, oh, wait, you might be about to say what I was about to say.
He busts out a statistic.
Yep, we both wrote it down.
He says, 45% of people still believe in ghosts. Which is when I started going, hold on a minute, citation needed. Where did you get this? And he follows that up with, and 100% of our appraisers believe in ghosts. So nobody is willing to go to this hotel and appraise it. Which becomes even more evident when she goes to the hotel and the first thing she sees is one of the appraisers they've tried to hire quickly and frighteningly leaving the hotel like something terrible has happened to him. Even though almost certainly it hasn't. He's been there for a little bit of an afternoon.
Matt, quick update. Quick update. These images turned out to have been from the WWE SummerSlam VIP kickoff party.
She was invited to the WWE SummerSlam VIP kickoff party?
I guess. I mean, she's there. There's photographic evidence of her and her feet.
I didn't need that extra detail at the end. But okay.
You know what I'm going to do? Just for a little, for the sake of a little bit of Movie Fighters continuity, I'm just going to type green M&M feet here into Google. You know what? Not as bad as just typing in green M&M. I will say that for free.
Okay. You know what? I the sick feeling that was building in my stomach is now lowering. I will tell you this: looking at Jen Lilly's filmography, in 2013, she was in the movies Revelation Road, The Beginning of the End, The Book of Esther, and Revelation Road 2, The Sea of Glass and Fire, all in 1 year.
Interesting. Could you click that link I just sent you real quick?
Is this... Oh, God. Here's how much we don't want to talk about this movie. Chris just sent me a drawing of the green M&M with titties. So that's great.
Yeah, you're welcome, buddy.
All right, so she gets to the end. This appraiser's leaving frantically. The first person she sees when she gets there is this guy. And Chris, I think you had a great description of this guy.
Well, he's the innkeeper. He's like the actual guy who runs the inn. And I said, hey, that guy kind of looks like Ron Perlman. But like not, you know? And you said, yeah, he kind of looks like Tom Waits, but not. And I was like, oh my God, he looks like Ron Perlman minus Tom Waits.
And that is 100% accurate.
It's exactly, when you see this dude, you will know exactly. I mean, you're not going to see this dude. Don't go watch this movie. It's trash. It's terrible. But like, if you did, that's exactly what he is. That equation checks
apparently,
out.
Apparently, his name is Robert Walsh. Apparently, he's a character actor who is in a lot of things, including Amistad and Crybaby.
Look, I will say this. I will say this right now. He's actually not bad in the role. Jen Lilly's actually not bad. And the lady who plays the innkeeper's love interest who shows up in the second act out of nowhere, also not bad. Everybody else in this movie is terrible.
Yes. Daniel is terrible. And everybody else from the 1920s is god awful. Such bad actors. The thing that the innkeeper tells Kate when she shows up is, oh, you should just leave. Because nobody's going to appraise this place, and it's never going to sell. So just go home. And she goes, well, no, the trust is making me sell this place, and you can't keep it open without an owner, so you have to let me stay here. And he goes, well, we close up for Christmas, and... you know, I'm not going to be here after next week. So, because she gets there on, what, December 13th? It's established that she has 3 weeks before the end of the year to sell this place. So she probably gets there on, like, December 12th or 13th. And all these dates are actually important. Because here's what we find out about Daniel. The last rum run that he ever went on was 12 days long. It started on December 13th. He got back on Christmas Eve, December 24th. And that's the day he died. So there are 12 days leading up to Christmas that he returns to this inn as a ghost and haunts it. The 12 days that he would have been gone for that rum run. Now, she insists on staying in the inn. The innkeeper leaves, and so she goes up to a room and, like, tries to sleep. She is not, there's not, like, rattling and shaking or opening of doors and closing or normal ghost stuff. What happens at this point is that Daniel walks into the room, says, you have to leave, picks her up, and tosses her out the door into the snow in her pajamas.
Yeah, he's like, hey, you gotta get out of here. To do my Kevin Owens impression, you gotta get out of here. Hey, get out of here. And then, like, walks, like, she's like, no, I'm not getting out of here. Like, it's my job. I have keys to the place. I'm in charge here. And so he just picks her up, carries her outside, and then throws a fucking blanket at her. It's snowing. It's snowing.
And at this point, she is not aware that he's a ghost. She thinks this is a guy who has come into the hotel and assaulted her.
Yes. Now, Matt, I mean, to be fair, I mean, she should believe he's a ghost, right? Because ghosts can normally just, like, show up and grab you, right?
All right, so let's talk about the ghost rules of this movie.
Oh, I wish you would.
Which are unbelievable.
Would you like to hear a list of things that we see the ghost doing in this movie?
Yes, please.
Okay, well, first thing we see him do is pick up Kate and throw her out of the house. Like, physically throw her out of the house. We see him punching in the code on the burglar alarm, which is when I asked you out loud, is the ghost putting in the code on the burglar alarm so that the police won't come? We see him eat a lot. Like, it's a whole thing about this movie. He's constantly eating. He's like fucking Brad Pitt in Ocean's 11.
There's an explanation for why he eats. Because there's a scene where he sits down to eat. Like a whole turkey.
He eats a fucking turkey.
And she asks the innkeeper, well, if he's a ghost, why does he eat? And the innkeeper responds by saying, oh, he just likes the sensation of it. He just enjoys doing it. Which is nonsense.
Yeah, well, to that I said, like, yeah, does he like to shit too? Like, oh man, you know what I miss when I'm not a ghost? When I'm not on the earthly plane? Is just taking a squeege, just popping one in and out.
Like, where does the food go? How is he able to eat it? Isn't it a waste of food if he doesn't have to eat?
Yeah. He is a physical presence. He is, like, real. You can touch him. He can interact with things. No problem. But the craziest goddamn thing we see him doing in this entire movie is iron his shirt.
He irons a shirt. To be fair, I guess, it is strictly there so there can be a scene where Kate walks in on him with his shirt off while he's ironing it. But that raises the further question of how he changes clothes, where those clothes are. Does he have a closet full of clothes? Is he generating these ghost clothes out of nothing? Where are they coming from?
Here's Daniel's deal. Daniel's deal is that every year he comes back from December 13th to December 25th. Midnight on Christmas, he's gone. So he's got the 12 days, which, incidentally, not the 12 days of Christmas. That's a discussion for another time. 12 days of Christmas are December 25th to January 6th, the Epiphany, when the three wise men arrived from the east with the gifts. Anyway, like, yeah, we see him in his room, right? Like, he talks about his bedroom. It's later revealed that he doesn't sleep because he's a ghost, obviously.
Yeah, like, yeah. He eats and can pick stuff up, and he mixes fucking drinks, and he reads books.
He works as a fucking bartender. He wears glasses.
He reads with glasses on. But he doesn't sleep, obviously.
Yeah. And when we find out he doesn't sleep, it's literally just Kate going, oh, right, you don't sleep. Like, it's an assumption that comes out of nowhere based on nothing. But we see his room, and his room is kind of decorated as it would, like, decorated old-timey. And when we see him ironing his clothes, like ironing a shirt, he's using, like, an old-fashioned iron, like you would heat up in a fire. Not an electric steam iron. So my question is, I will buy, since we see him wearing multiple outfits, but it's all his clothes from the 20s, right? Like, it's all his vintage period clothing. My question is, when he comes back from the void, when he comes back on December 13th every year, is he A, just wearing the same clothes he was wearing on December 25th the previous year? Like, time has not passed for him. And then he just goes in, and all these clothes from the 20s are just remarkably well-preserved in the closet. Or B, does he show up like the fucking Terminator, naked, like on the lawn of this B&B?
Well, this ends up going. This ends up going way beyond the question of his clothes, because this brings up the question of when it's not those 12 days that he's haunting the inn, where the fuck does he go? Because the whole last act of this movie is about him moving on, right? Moving on to the beyond, moving on to heaven. So if he's not a presence on Earth 353 days of the year, where the fuck does he go?
I mean, I just assume that – I assume it's no time passing.
I guess.
I assume that he like blips out, blips back in, like teleports the time.
Either the people who wrote this script, and we're going to talk about the script, believe me. Either the people who wrote this script spent all their time figuring out their ghost rules, or spent no time at all.
Oh, I have a wager.
Ghost rules.
I know what I would put my money on. Daniel doesn't have any ghost powers. Like, not only is he like a physical presence who can eat and wear glasses and iron a shirt and fucking do cocktail Tom Cruise shit, he also doesn't, as near as we can tell, he does not like walk through walls. He doesn't like do ghost shit at all. When he's hiding from the sheriff that Kate is calling because there's a man in her house who attacked her, he like we see from his perspective like hiding in the floorboards. Like we see him physically hiding. The only thing he can do is that he can't leave the property. He can't leave the inn.
Okay, so this ties back into where the plot and the movie is going. After Kate calls the sheriff and the sheriff's like, I don't see anybody, Daniel pops up and she's like, you're a dude in the house and I have to be here. You can't make me leave. It's my job to be here. You're some weirdo who's harassing me. And Daniel says, no, I'm a ghost. I'm tied to this property. I can't leave. I have all the keys. This is my house. And she goes, I don't believe you. So he has to prove it to her. And the way that he proves it to her is that he walks her out to the property line, tries to walk off the property, and promptly disappears.
He disappears, and then she goes back inside the inn. She walks back to the inn and walks inside.
That's right.
And he's sitting on the stairs, like, with a knife carving up an apple and eating it.
Yeah, and he's like, is that enough proof for you? Speaking of which, Daniel, in the first act of this movie, is a 100% asshole.
He's a piece of shit. He's a real dick.
Even when she's trying to ask him questions, because finally she believes that he's a ghost, and she's like, okay, so how can we work this out so that it's good for everybody? I'll help you deal with whatever it is that brings you back here for 12 days every year. You'll be gone, and then I can sell this place. So tell me what you did and how you died, and maybe we can get this worked out. And his immediate reaction is to go, this is my life. You're treating my life like a story. And I'm ashamed of what I was doing back in the 20s before I died.
Well,
What is it? Improper? It was improper.
She asks him what he was doing. She's like, okay, well, why were you in Canada right before you came back and died? And he goes, it's not honorable. And I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. Are you from the 1800s or a fucking Klingon? Because he doesn't speak as modern as Ichabod Crane on Sleepy Hollow.
It's true. That's another script thing I want to talk about later. But he's cagey. Like, he's got weird antiquated ideas, which I guess makes sense because he's from the 20s. But, like, they're even more antiquated than you would think some ideas somebody from the 20s would have. You know, the era of flappers.
Yeah, this guy does not seem like he is from the time of the Great Gatsby. This guy seems like he's from, like the Revolution.
This dude seems like he should have owned slaves.
He's got he's got his weird accent. He's got like his weird ideas about things. He says to Kate at one point later in the movie, he's like, "Oh, your friend's name, like, oh, hey, it says Molly on your special device." Not, like, on your phone. Because he's talking about her cell phone. And I get that.
Okay, he's talking to the innkeeper at that point. But someone has definitely used the word cell phone around him. Because one thing that we find out is that he and the innkeeper have this kind of deal where the innkeeper is going to protect him. And they're kind of pals. We see them playing chess at one point. Mm-hmm. Also, they're playing chess all wrong. They're moving pieces in the way that those pieces do not move. But they're buddies. So certainly the innkeeper has been like, oh, I'm getting a call on my phone, on my cell phone. Obviously, he should have picked up what that word means. Unless he cannot learn anything. Well, but we know he can learn stuff because he learns Kate's name.
They try to write around so much stuff. Like, oh yeah, he's not familiar with cell phones because, like, earlier in the movie, the innkeeper's like, oh yeah, you know, we have a deal. Like, I do not interact with him. He's a ghost. He wants to be left alone. So the entire time I've been working here, which is like 30 years, every Christmas I just leave his ass alone. So presumably, Daniel is up in his room just reading books published before 1930 for 12 days a year, every year, since for the past 70 years, for the past 80 years, right?
Which has somehow led to newspaper articles about the place being haunted.
I want to make it very, very clear that Daniel does not have ghost powers. He never displays the ability to do, like, any Ghostbuster shit. He doesn't possess anybody, walk through walls, move anything. He can't turn invisible. He is, like, a straight-up, which is fine if that's how ghosts are going to work in your movie. So, Matt, it's a good thing another ghost never shows up that can turn invisible, walk through walls, and do a bunch of ghost shit.
There are two other ghosts.
They obey the same rules, right? They obey the same ghost rules that this movie has laid out for it, for the spirit of Christmas.
The mystery that pops up in the second act is about there being another ghost in the inn. And somehow it's assumed that this other ghost is the person that killed Daniel, even though there is no reason to necessarily believe that.
Well, this, you say second act, this shit comes in real late. Because, like,
yeah,
it's just assumed that Daniel, like, this is the ghost that's been scaring everybody away, and everybody just assumes it's Daniel, because Daniel apparently showed up on the innkeeper's first Christmas there, and was like, yo, come out to the property line with me so I can prove to you I'm a ghost, so that you will leave my ass alone. So whenever anybody comes to him and is like, hey, room 36 is haunted, he's like, yeah, yeah, it's Daniel, it's whatever. Everybody blames all the second ghost activities on him, even though it's not what Daniel's doing. But, like,
and that
continues until, like, 20 minutes from the end of the movie.
And it is news to Daniel that there's another ghost in the house.
Yeah.
Which you'd think he would have noticed. But it's only when Kate gets there and, like, doors are randomly closing, then ghost shit starts happening. Doors are randomly closing, the window opens, there's weird noises, like, she's going, like, walking around in a robe trying to figure out what's going on, thinking that it's Daniel because she knows he's a ghost. And for a while, she blames him for it. Which leads to a kind of, like, you know, manufactured conflict between Kate and Daniel for a little while. After which, they immediately fall in love, like it's no biggie. But the, like, she thinks that this other ghost is Daniel, but Daniel's not doing any of this shit. And Daniel has no awareness that any of this is happening at all. But as it turns out, there are two other ghosts in the house, one of whom is his ex-fiance, who we find out married his brother as a cover for her having Daniel's son conceived before his death. The other ghost is Daniel's cousin, who was running whiskey with him from Canada and had basically been ordered to hit Daniel by the crime boss that was employing them. Both of them are haunting the hotel as well. They are disappearing and doing all kinds of crazy-ass ghost shit. We see the cousin character, whose name is Harry, which I would say is a nod to It's a Wonderful Life, but I don't know that any of this is. But we see Harry go through a wall in a very shitty special effect.
Oh, it's the pits.
We see the ex-fiance, Lily, disappearing and reappearing like crazy. And we also find out that Lily is the reason that Daniel has been left at the hotel to begin with, because I don't know why. It's not getting revenge or finding out what happened with his murder that is keeping him here. It's something having to do with his ex-fiance. We don't really find out what, but she's been keeping him here for 90-some years without ever bothering to tell him, because he didn't even know she was there. Shit is fucked up. I don't understand it.
Nothing makes sense. Like, nothing makes sense in this movie.
Because for a while, after they figure out what's going on and there must be another ghost in the house, it becomes this whole thing where Kate and Daniel are like, okay, we're going to find out who killed Daniel. And once we know that, Daniel will be able to stop haunting the hotel and everything will be great. And that is the mystery of the second part of the movie, of the middle of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
None of it matters at all.
The only thing that keeps this movie at its excruciating 91-minute running time is there keep being, like, multiple scenes of, like, Daniel getting, like, real pissed off at Kate and, like, being like, you need to leave.
Or,
and then Kate being like, oh no, he's mad at me. How can I fix this? This asshole ghost that I'm trying to help move on to fucking heaven is angry with me.
Or, conversely, ghost shit happens in the house and Kate blames it on Daniel.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of, like, misplaced blame going on, even though the blame directed toward Daniel, who is an asshole, is not misplaced at all.
Yeah.
There's a scene where Daniel goes, where's your husband? And she goes, I'm not married. And don't come at me with this stuff about how you think I should be married, because the times are different. And what he says after that is not, oh, sorry, I know times are different. He goes, so who's your beau? Like, motherfucker, she just got done telling you that it's a different time where maybe she doesn't need a man in her life. So after all of this stuff happens and this mystery gets set up, she gets sent back to Boston on the premise, because her boss calls her and he tells her, hey, you got to get back here. One, you were supposed to have the inn appraised by now, because it's like December 20th by this point. You were supposed to have the place appraised by now. You haven't done it. And this senator, who's one of our clients, has died. So we got a lot of work to do. All hands on deck. You got to get back here. She goes back. She has no choice but to go back to Boston. But she promises the innkeeper and Daniel that she'll come back before Christmas Eve. So she goes back to Boston and apparently gets all the work done for the senator's estate, the senator's will, in like a day. Because the next scene we see is her and her boss in an office where he's like, better get that inn appraised. What have you been doing? Were you on vacation? Have you been skiing? And she tells, in what might be the funniest thing in the whole movie, she tells him, oh, well, there it actually is haunted, and I've been working with the ghost to solve his murder so that he can move on to the beyond. And the boss is like, you should have just told me you were skiing. Then, out of the blue, while she's still in Boston, she gets a phone call about the place has been appraised. The appraiser we saw at the beginning of the movie comes back. It's been appraised because Daniel has called him. And now the hotel is ready to be sold. Because that's what Daniel thinks Kate wants. He's trying to, because they're in love now, he's doing what he thinks she wants. She also gets a file while she's sitting around working.
Mm-hmm.
And in that file, she finds the birth certificate for Daniel's son, on which he is listed as the father. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you how much that matters. Not at all. It's explained that the marriage between Daniel's brother and his fiance is a cover-up for the son being born so that they wouldn't think that son was born out of wedlock. But Daniel, who is dead, is listed on the birth certificate as the father. So it does make a goddamn bit of sense.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, Matt, like, they didn't have the Freedom of Information Act back in the past.
All right, fair enough. So Kate goes back to the inn because there's this whole thing where she's supposed to go to the office Christmas party on Christmas Eve. The boss says priorities. She comes back to the inn. She's playing the piano. Daniel sees her. She turns to Daniel and she says priorities to him because obviously, you know, romance is more important than career. So there's a Christmas party that occurs at the inn. While this Christmas party is going on, Daniel remembers who killed him.
Oh, does he remember? Does he remember, or does he look around the room and he sees his wife and, like, looks at her and, like, relives a little bit of the past as a third party, like moving around in the past as if it is happening right now, and then come back to the party and then look around and see literally a dude holding a bloody rock standing in the Christmas party? Is that what happens?
That is exactly what happens.
I think that's what you meant.
Yeah, that is exactly what happens. That leads to a showdown between Daniel and his cousin Harry. Harry said that he had to kill Daniel because of the crime boss guy. Daniel says he forgives him. Harry disappears. So Harry has been sent back to the beyond because he got forgiveness from Daniel. I don't know that that exactly gets you off the hook for murder in the afterlife, but here it seems to work. Then we see the fiance still standing over there. She kind of coyly standing in a corner and goes away. Daniel and Kate embrace, dance, kiss as the clock leads to midnight on Christmas. Daniel thinks that he's going to disappear at midnight on Christmas.
He does.
But when
he does. His wife shows up and she's like, because she tells him, like, she gets, like, really kind of frustrated with him because she's like, hey, I kept you here so that you could, like, for vague reasons that no one understands. Like, we don't know why she's keeping him here. She's like, but now you have to choose. Now you have to choose. And she, like, turns around and marches off back to heaven.
I don't think he disappears, though, because he's still holding Kate when it's 12:01, and he lays, who has fallen asleep while they were kissing.
Oh, that's right. She does fall asleep, and he, like, puts her on the most uncomfortable-looking Victorian love seat to sleep on, where she has to, like, curl up into a ball to not look like it's the most uncomfortable thing in the world.
And by all indications, Jen Lilly, like, they can't even hide that she is a short person in this movie. Mm-hmm. Like, she is 5 feet tall max. And even she looks mega uncomfortable on this couch.
Mm-hmm.
So he's still there. And his fiance is like, all right, now's your opportunity to choose. I'm giving you the choice. She walks off to go back to, you know, her beautiful afterlife. And Daniel decides that he's going to go back to be with Kate. So the last scene of the movie, Kate wakes up off the couch. She encounters the innkeeper who says he's going to buy the inn along with his new lady friend. They've put in a bid for the inn. They're going to buy it. Then somehow the door is open to the inn. She sees Daniel out in the woods. Daniel approaches the house and he said, I decided to stay. There's some kind of whole thing with a watch that Daniel had.
I think he gives her the watch. Because the watch isn't a
and
ghost
then
watch.
He gives her the watch. He says it won't open. She gives it back to him. And it opens then. I don't understand that even a little bit. But the watch plays a big part in the last thing that happens in the movie. Then they kiss, and that's the end of the movie, with no explanation as to whether Daniel can leave the property now, how, like, what the logistics of their relationship is going to be. Seemingly, he's not just around for 12 days a year anymore.
Well,
he's around
all
the time.
What he says is, but he goes, 12 days isn't enough.
Yeah. But there are so many lingering questions.
I mean, presumably he's just back to life and he will age and die as normal. Probably, like, sooner because he's from, like, he's gonna get polio and then immediately die because he eats a whole fucking turkey.
All right, but if he's back to life, does he have a social security card? Is he on the grid? What kind of identifying information does he have? All right, Chris, are there any high points of The Spirit of Christmas?
No. No, it's not. It's not good. It's not good.
All right, I'm gonna give it two things, all right? Until the last 20 minutes or so, when we were both just exhausted by this whole thing, mm-hmm. and it really fell apart and made no sense. Until then, it was fun to watch and joke about and make fun of. And by that same token, I think you have pointed out the actors who do a pretty good job in this movie. Robert Walsh as the innkeeper is not bad. Joanna Harrington as Molly, the pub owner, is not bad. And Jen Lilly does a respectable job as Kate.
Jen Lilly's working real hard with the material, and especially given her co-star, who is a very good-looking gentleman who does not seem to feel emotions.
I'll give it this one last high point. Here's one last high point. His hair is correct for the period.
Yes. I mean, I think that's why 45% of people believe in ghosts, because, you know, they see the correct hair.
All right, we have a lot to run through on low points for The Spirit of Christmas. Let's start with Thomas Baudouin cannot say anything in a way that is not completely monotone. The character he plays is an asshole, and he is he never gets beyond being a bland but handsome man.
Yeah, he literally, I am trying to think of a redeeming quality for him, and there is not one. What does he do anything in this movie that is endearing other than have a decent reason to be mad at his wife and his brother for getting married?
Not that I can think of.
He's just a really unpleasant, surly guy. There's no moment of connection with him to Kate, especially, other than the fact that one time we see him with his shirt off and he's a good-looking gentleman.
Yeah, he's handsome. That's it. He's bad. The actor who plays Harry is okay, but also talks really weird.
Yes.
Aside from bad dialogue, which we'll get to in a second, he just talks weird. Now, the characters who play Daniel's brother and his fiance.
Oh my god, is the hug by itself a low point?
The hug by itself is a low point, but their performances in general are sub-community theater. They are so bad.
Just
I thought the twist of the movie was going to be that this was instead of an inn, it was a community theater production of a play about the 20s.
And he was like a ghost from the 80s.
Yeah.
He was like a ghost from 1993.
Yeah, and this was a bad play, because the actors who play Lily and Charles, the fiancé and brother, are abysmally terrible. They can't even really get out a line. And then, yes, we see at the end of the movie, from their perspective, because Daniel's watching all this in third person, like he's fucking Scrooge. He sees the conversation between his fiance and his brother about him and how, really more than anything, she's just worried about Daniel, right? And there's this part where they hug, and neither one of them hugs the other like a human being has ever hugged a human being. I don't even know how to describe it.
It's okay. Here's what he does. And this is a good time if you are listening to this with a significant other or someone who you just want to give a hug to. It could be someone like me and Matt. It could be someone like Matt and Marlene. But what you do is the person who's being hugged stands stock still, arms down, arms at your sides. Do not move your arms.
Rigid.
No space between arms and your sides. Keep those down. The hugger is going to put one hand around the tops of the shoulders. So your hand's going to go around, and then your left hand is going to grab the other person's left shoulder and make sure it is parallel to the ground. It is a high parallel grab. Then the other hand comes around, boom, back of the head.
It is
And I should point out, the person who's being hugged should be shorter. So that the person has to kind of lean forward to get this incredibly awkward hug.
Like shoulder height. Like, yeah. Considerably shorter. And then the hug shifts in the middle of it, so it's kind of around the back of the head and the neck.
Yeah, because you want to keep, like, once that hand is on the back of the head, you keep moving it until you're, like, kind of cradling the back of the head. It's no human, like, we said the exact same thing at the same time when that was happening, was, look at that extremely human hug.
Look at that hug, the way that people hug.
Yeah, look at that hug, the way humans hug. The way, like real people hug.
Oh my god. Like, that... I could do a whole podcast just about how awkward and weird that hug is.
It is by itself a low point. It's amazing.
Another low point is the script. On multiple occasions, we refer to the script as fan fiction-y. It may even be below the quality level of fan fiction-y. Because here's the thing. Daniel doesn't talk like a person from the 20s. I haven't seen many talkies from the 1920s, but I've seen movies from the 1930s and 1940s. People didn't talk like that back then. He talks like somebody from, like you were saying, from like revolutionary times.
Yes.
It's all just like antiquated words and big vocabulary here and there. And very stilted, like, old-fashioned. It's just generally old-fashioned.
The last season of Power Rangers, the team featured a caveman and a knight from the 1300s, both of whom had come to the future. They were more believable characters from the past than Daniel is in this movie.
And Kate talks strangely sometimes, too. Like, Jen Lilly does pretty good with the material that she has, but... Even, she can't get out some of this dialogue that's so disjointed and, like, nobody talks.
Yeah. Well, nobody has anything to work with in this. Like, it is, you really, honest to God, cannot even blame the actors, even the ones that we think are kind of bad, because they just, there's, like, nothing to work with. Like, Thomas Baudouin is not, like, good, but he's also working with a character who is written without anything to latch onto. And when, like, we talked about it feeling fanfiction-y, and it's not, like, the feeling that it is, I think I've pinned it down, Matt, is that there's a romance story happening between, like, this feels like fanfiction for a property in which Kate and Daniel are characters, but that do not know each other and do not have any textual evidence to support their romance. But by God, this movie's going to have that romance happen, whether there's a reason for it or not. Someone just decided they should be together.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, somebody shipped these two characters from this thing and decided to put them together, even though it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
The script is very bad. Also, I want to talk a little bit about the music in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, and I've made this abundantly clear, Carol of the Bells is used abundantly in this movie.
This is specific
and
to
I
you. This is specific to you.
I absolutely hate Carol of the Bells. And Chris asked me while we were watching it, why do you dislike Carol of the Bells so much? And I explained it to him. Because it makes me anxious. It is the most anxiety-inducing music I could imagine. The pacing of it, the tempo of it, the key, everything about it is just intended to give me a panic attack. I hate it. It's throughout this movie. And none of the music is consistent. Like, there's like little piano arrangements of the 12 Days of Christmas. But there's one scene, okay, somewhere around the middle of the movie, Kate decides to go get a Christmas tree and bring it back to the inn so that they can put up a Christmas tree. It's sort of an olive branch to Daniel. It's sort of an apology to Daniel for blaming him for all the weird ghost shit that's going on in the hotel. When she's driving back with the Christmas tree, there's this kind of jazzy piano number that I described as being by the Vince G. Rowlady trio.
It was the hardest I laughed today, was that joke.
Because it is so the, like, legally distinct from Charlie Brown Christmas kind of music you could imagine. So the music is very bad. It's only competently directed. I mean, I guess the lighting's okay. Like, just like, there's nothing to really sell you on this movie.
Yeah, it's bad.
With that, Chris, what are our final thoughts on the spirit of Christmas?
First of all, this is the least Christmassy movie we have ever done for a Movie Fighters Christmas movie.
I don't know that it's less Christmassy than The Christmas Bounty, but they're in the neighborhood of each other.
Yeah. I feel like when there's two dudes on a podcast, because, you know, like, so many podcasts are just two dudes talking to each other, I feel like there's a temptation to make an assumption that we are rejecting a genre of film, the romantic drama or romantic comedy that is traditionally, like, oriented towards women, because we're dudes, and because we're dismissing it for that reason. And look, like I said, I've watched so many of these. Like, I wish we could have done 12 Dates of Christmas. It's so fun and goofy. Like, it's...
Well, that was what I was going to say for my final thought. It's just like, instead of watching The Spirit of Christmas, watch 12 Dates of Christmas. Yeah. Because it's got Mark Paul Gosselaar, who is a charming gentleman.
Yes.
And Amy Smart, who is very good. Like, I tend to like Amy Smart in everything I see her in. And seems like a charming romantic comedy set at Christmas.
Yes. It's not that this is in a genre that is not our favorite. It's that this movie's, like, bad. Like, this movie is nonsense. Yeah.
It doesn't make a lick of sense, and it doesn't... Whenever it decides what kind of movie it is, what genre it's in, it changes. And when it sets up something to pay off later, it decides that that thing doesn't matter at all. And it's very frustrating for those reasons. Because honestly, for much of the running time of this movie, I would not consider it to be a romantic comedy. I would consider it to be a semi-spooky ghost movie, a mystery story, some kind of historical fiction thing, and any number of other genres that are not romantic comedy. Because at no point is it even really a comedy. At best, it would be a romantic drama or just a romance.
I mean, like, it's clearly not a romantic comedy. It's not, like, funny. But it's not, again, it's not a good romance. There's no reason for these characters to be attracted to each other. Like, we were talking about how if this dude is like, you know, when she's like, hey, what were you doing in Canada? He's like, it isn't honorable. And he's talking about, like, you know, being a bootlegger in the 20s before Prohibition was overturned. Like, that dude ain't gonna have a good time in 2016. Like, he's like, don't let him near a television or he's gonna be having a real bad time.
Yeah, and he gets all judgy with her about not having a husband, or, like, assumes it. And yet, her reaction to him is like, this guy. Like, that other guy who I dumped at the beginning of the movie, who was just kind of boring, no way. But this guy, who clearly has the opposite beliefs that I have in many, many ways, him. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. This guy who I'm literally always going to be competing with the actual specter of his dead love, whose love for him kept him bound to Earth for 80 years. Yeah, this is good. Like, look, Spirit of Christmas 2 is a divorce movie, guaranteed.
Well, she is an attorney.
Yeah, she's gonna take him for everything he has, which is nothing, because as you said, Matt, he is off the grid. He is a deceased individual.
Watch. Yeah, I would love to see that fucking ghost in court. All right, everybody. That's it for the December 2016 Movie Fighters.
Hey, keep in mind, we could have watched Beethoven. We could have watched a fun dog movie.
I don't know that we would have had any better luck with that. Kick in a few dollars at patreon.com/warrocketajax to ensure that snack situation specials happen every month in 2017. So if you have a couple bucks to kick over on patreon.com/warrocketajax, please go ahead and do that. We would really appreciate it. It also gets you ad-free episodes of this show and of War Rocket Ajax, and other bonus stuff as well. You can check it all out on Patreon. Our website was designed by Sean Bogus. Our music is by Michael Kill. Michael's name is spelled M-I-K-A-L-K-H-I-L-L, which may not sound exactly like what it's, or is not spelled exactly what it sounds like. And I had people asking me what it was spelled, how it was spelled. So that's how you spell Michael's name. Go check out his music. It's very good. He's on Bandcamp, and you should get all of it. The Snack Situation theme is by Matt Fisher. We'll be back in January with another movie. We have yet to decide what that is, but I'm sure it'll be something good. Chris, we made it through Spirit of Christmas. Maybe there will be a Miz movie to save us next year. I hope so. Until next month, everybody.
Happy holidays, everybody. Regardless of what you're celebrating or if you're celebrating, we hope... Hope you're having a good time.
This has been a Kleitas Media production.